Hello and welcome to Something's Off with Andrew Heaton. I'm your host, Andrew Heaton, and I think you look terrific in that shirt. Not a lot of people can pull off chartreuse tassels, but you can because you have guts. And that's why we're friends. Quick shout out to listeners in Switzerland. There are three of you, apparently. My producers have been letting me play with the analytics, despite a lot of protests from them. They keep telling me I should work on other stuff. But I've been looking at the analytics. Got three of you in Switzerland. Guten Tag, or, you know what, there's a bunch of languages over there. I don't know Romanish. Hello. Also, hi to Boise, Idaho, who has pole vaulted over my anemic listenership in Los Angeles, which is dead to me. Well done, Boise, Idaho. You all clearly have excellent taste in podcasts. And hello to Christian McKinley, who lives, or at least works, in the sky. I don't understand how analytics works. It just said he's in the sky. I assume he's a pilot or an angel or something. I don't know. Anyway, Something's Off with Andrew Heaton is brought to you by Flip Flops Resort on St. Murray Island, a terrific two-star facility the whole family will enjoy. I've been to Flip Flops a couple of times, and let me tell you, it is a stupendous beachfront community, if you're into that kind of thing. I am not a beach person at all, really. In my opinion, beaches are just deserts with a hole at the end. But I'm in the minority on that one, I know that. I would be perfectly fine if Congress forbade me to ever see a beach again. In fact, I would like to get successful enough that I never experience anything hotter than 80 degrees Fahrenheit for the rest of my life under any circumstance. The moment Texas starts being all Texas, come summer, I would be on a plane to Maine or Scotland. That is the goal. But again, I am an exception. Most people love beaches, and for that reason, most people love Flip Flops Resort. Now, it has been in the news a little lately, and that's warranted, but I think we can view vacation deals a lot like plunging stock prices. For example, a bunch of people died on Boeing flights recently, so Boeing stocks are down. Seems like a good time to buy stock in Boeing, doesn't it? Likewise, some people died at Flip Flops, which at least on a financial level makes it way more affordable than the Virgin Islands. They say lightning never strikes twice, and murder is basically the same thing, so for a murder to happen 9 times in 1 year is already so statistically unlikely that the probability of a 10th murder happening on your vacation is next to zilch. Crunching the numbers here, going to Flip Flops Resort is statistically the least likely place to get decapitated based on global averages. Seems to me St. Murray Island already has had way more than its fair share of decapitations, so I'd be a lot more worried about hitting up St. Thomas Island, where there are hardly any. There do. That's how statistics work. Also, if you're a history buff like I am, the whole area is really fun to explore. Did you know that St. Murray Island used to be a haven for pirates? That's pretty neat. And it's the only island in the world which is jointly administered by the Cuban government and the Florida Keys Sewage Services Department. Also, Flip Flops Resort is built on top of an old voodoo pet cemetery. You're not going to get that at St. Bart's. No, sir. So make your next vacation one at Flip Flops Resort on St. Murray Island. Flip Flops Resort. Don't believe the TripAdvisor reviews. It's actually very pleasant. And now, before we bring on the guest, it's time for another installment of How To with Heaton. This week, how to make sense of a horoscope. If you've got an easy sign like Pisces or Sagittarius, just buy a run-of-the-mill horoscope from the grocery store or a newspaper or whatever, because you don't even need to put any work into it. Just keep having a breezy Sagittarius life. But if you've got a harder month like Leo, here's what you want to do. First, understand that horoscopes are the ancient science of astrology, whereby sages can predict the future by applying the pattern of planets and stars to our lives. So it's imperative you know what the planets are up to. Therefore, drive down to the planetarium, take a seat, and when the presenter starts talking about constellations, shout, "Hey, Egghead, what's Jupiter gonna do?" Now that guy doesn't want to reveal his cards because he knows knowledge is power. He's going to try and ignore you. You just keep heckling. Yeah, we're all made from stardust, blah, blah, blah. Get to Mercury retrograde, nerd. Don't give up until he tells you exactly what Jupiter is doing. Now, that's just Leo. What if you're a moderately difficult sign like Gemini? In that case, you're going to want to go to an actual observatory. Break in and peep through the telescope yourself. Can you see Jupiter? If so, great. Buy green bananas. If not, bad sign. Buy Bitcoin. Cancer is a tricky one. That's a tricky sign. If you're Cancer, You don't have to go to a planetarium, but you do have to find an astronomer with a telescope. Once you locate the astronomer, grip one end of the telescope and tell the astronomer to make a wish. Then the two of you just start pulling. When the telescope breaks in half, the wish comes true for whoever has the biggest half of the telescope. Working our way up the zodiac food chain, we get to Taurus, which means crab. This one is a doozy. If you're a Taurus and you really want to know the future, you need to head to Mountain View, California, and sneak into the SETI Institute where they look for aliens. Hop on one of their computers and type out, "Hey aliens, can you guys see Jupiter?" If the aliens say yes, great sign. Ask someone out on a date. If the aliens say no, horrible sign. Anyone you ask on a date gets cancer. Now we're getting pretty high up the zodiac hierarchy at this point, which means we're up to Virgo, the most mysterious of the zodiac signs. In order to read your horoscope, you must purchase a deck of tarot cards. Shuffle the deck, lay two cards in front of you, and then flip them over. If they're both Jupiter, excellent. Two Jupiters is a fantastic sign. Immediately buy real estate on credit. But if it's a telescope, I don't even want to tell you. But it involves Cancer and lots of it. The next zodiac sign is, of course, baritone. If you're a baritone, you're going to need to get a mug and some tea leaves. Pour hot water over the tea leaves and then stir it with a telescope. If the ensuing pattern looks like Jupiter, the next time you go to McDonald's, they're going to give you extra French fries. But if the tea leaves look like one of the evil planets, specifically Neptune, your old high school will realize that you filled a form out wrong, and so your diploma is invalid, and you're going to have to go back and take 11th grade algebra again. Finally, the hardest zodiac signs are Capricorn and Mezzo-Capricorn. If you're one of these, you have to kidnap Neil deGrasse Tyson. Hold him hostage for 2 or 3 days without explanation. Then one day, kick the door open to the basement and point a loaded pistol at him and shout, "I don't know if you did it or not, and frankly, I don't care. Just tell me what Jupiter is doing, old man. Do it! Do it!" If Neil deGrasse Tyson says Jupiter is looking good in the neighborhood, then everything is peachy, and you should ask your boss for a raise. But if he says Jupiter's looking fine supper time, moths are going to eat all your clothes, even the polyester ones, and your spouse will leave you for an Elton John impersonator. And that's how you read a horoscope. My guest today is Brian Sack. He is a writer, an actor, a comedian, and a friend of mine, a very funny guy. Brian, thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me, Andrew. And on another note, I just did something for Neil deGrasse Tyson. I'm going to be on his show.
Oh, really?
How's that for some kind of weird connection?
Wow. That right there is because we were talking about horoscopes. It's getting all spooky.
Yeah.
Congratulations on that. And we're going to talk about Poland today because you've got some connections to that. Before we do that, two things. Brian, sure. You can't see this, but because we have Blaze TV subscriptions, I am on camera. And I did actually ask one of my coworkers to loan me a gun to point at the camera while I was pretending to threaten Neil deGrasse Tyson. The security guard literally said, "I have to give that back now." So my producer's going to come out and I'm just going to hand the gun off to him real quick.
Okay. It's a legit sidearm. It's a real weapon.
Yeah, and you would not believe how many people wanted to talk to me about this in terms of, you know, I wanted to make sure it wasn't loaded, of course, weren't even okay with me keeping it in the desk for this segment with you. They wanted it for like the 50 seconds that it was on camera, and then they wanted it out of the building. So
in case I did some kind of thing where I kind of hypnotized you into pulling it out of the drawer.
That's right. Yeah, you would go Heaton. Code word Excelsior. And then I would get this really weird Manchurian candidate look on my eyes and track down and murder whoever it was you programmed me to kill. So you've been foiled, Brian. And before we get into Poland, I want to throw out real quick. You've done a lot of really funny things, but I loved your series BS of A, which was actually on the Blaze. So if there's Blaze people that are going, whatever happened to Brian? He's on the program now and is still funny and doing awesome things.
I'm here. And yeah, they reach out to me on Twitter.
Good. Yeah. Really? And I'll say BS of A, really funny sketch program. That's how I stumbled onto you. And then I reached out to you because I wanted advice on doing my own comedy programs. And it turns out that you're funny and a really nice guy and agreed to come have a tax deductible lunch with me.
I sure did.
Yeah.
And that paid off.
It did. It worked. And now we're hanging out.
Yeah.
So I had mentioned a couple of topics to you that I asked you for topics you thought would be fun to discuss. And one of the ones you brought up was Poland. And so we're going to do a little bit of foreign policy work today for those listening. We're going to get into what's happening in Poland.
Because who doesn't want to learn about Poland?
And who doesn't want to get their foreign policy chops from two comedians? I feel like we are the best people. You could go to Council on Foreign Relations, but are you going to get awesome horoscope-related Neil deGrasse Tyson jokes? Probably not.
Exactly.
So, it's going to be better. What's your connection to Poland? Were you an ambassador or how are you connected?
Very close. Very close. I married a Polish woman who I met in an Irish bar in France.
Perfect.
A lot of culture. A lot of culture.
You are a very cosmopolitan family. So as a result of that, are you all keeping tabs on Poland?
Yeah, I kind of started visiting there in 2000 and mm-hmm. have been there many times. And since American politics is so boring, I just said, why not follow Polish politics?
That makes total, they say American politics is the oatmeal of global politics, whereas Poland would be the... My metaphor is rapidly breaking down. Is schnitzel Polish? It's German, isn't it? You know what?
It's close enough. It's a little to the west.
But every once in a while that schnitzel gets into Poland. So like that's a little bit of a World War II joke for you.
They have schnitzel, but it's called kotlet.
Oh, nice. Okay. And I think your kids have Polish names too, don't they?
They do.
Okay. So you've been, and I do that. I reference Scotland a periodic amount on the program as well. So I think you've got that kind of dual country identity thing working, which is cool.
I really fell in love with Poland when I first started visiting, and then as an homage, we gave our kids Polish names. My youngest son has a hard to spell one that he has to explain every time, so I've kind of traumatized him.
Did you give him squiggly letters?
He doesn't have squiggly letters, but it's just a weird letter combination, like SIU at the end, which most people say SIU. Mm-hmm. It's actually shoe, and so it's just a big mess.
When I have kids, I want to give them like normal names, but I want one of them to have an asterisk at the end of it so that whenever they're being called out in class, the person will keep looking at the bottom of the page to see if there's some sort of additional information. So, which I think will be funny forever and definitely not problematic for the kid as they get older. I've been to Poland once. I went there. I went through Central and Eastern Europe a couple of years ago. I had a very good time, very much enjoyed it. I was in Krakow.
Okay, I love Krakow, great city.
And there's also a, this is pretty much the only Polish anecdote I have, and then we can get into the foreign policy realm. But there's a longstanding connection between Edinburgh, between Scotland and Poland, because the Poles were, the Polish government during World War II went into exile. So kind of setting the stage for what we're about to talk about, several countries that were conquered by Germany were sort of, were state administered by a, kind of a Vichy regime type thing. So Belgium and I think the Netherlands and a couple of other countries, their government remained in place. Poland didn't do that. Poland was very much conquered and the government went into exile. There wasn't sort of like a Polish governor general that was under the strings of the Nazis. So the leadership fled or went into hiding. A lot of them were hanging out in Scotland, and particularly the army, because the Free Polish Army would go over there. And during the war, they're fighting in, at one point, I think Syria or somewhere in the Middle East. And the Poles, who are fun crazy, had introduced a bear to their army. Like they had a bear that was basically a mascot, and they thought it was really funny to teach it how to smoke and drink beer, and they would take it with them from battle to battle. And I think Eisenhower found out, and so he made this like allied-wide rule that you couldn't have animal mascots with you in the army anymore because that could cause problems. And so the Poles legally declared the bear, his name was Wojciech, they declared Wojciech a corporal in their army, making the bear outrank several of the other people. And they would literally take him into battle and stuff. And the bear would somehow carry munitions to fight Nazis. And I'll say this, the bear deserved it. If the bear actually fought the Nazis, as he appears to have done, he deserved that rank. He wound up living in the Edinburgh Zoo. And for years, these old Polish guys would hop the fence and jump into the zoo to give the bear cigarettes and hug it. Heartwarming tale of why you should never go to war with Poland because all the people are crazy.
That is something I did not know, actually.
Yeah.
I've actually always compared Poland to Ireland because they have, a 99% Catholic population, a national alcohol problem, and they're very literate. They're very well read.
Yeah, and they've been conquered a bunch of times.
Yeah, they have. Yeah, but the Poles more so, I think.
Yeah, I'm not super up on Polish history, but they Christianize around right around 1000 AD, I think. They come in right before the Great Schism, and then they merge with Lithuania for a while, and we're like actually like a really big power. And then they like 1790, I think, or around like, because it's around, it's somewhere between our revolution and the French Revolution. They have this really kicking, you know, kind of forward-thinking constitution they put in place where the townspeople are all made equal to nobles and the peasants are under the protection of the government and there's a constitutional monarch. And then almost immediately, Russia, Austria, and Prussia go, like, we
do
that. Not, yeah, we don't like this business. We're autocrats.
That's a no.
So they invade them, and they've pretty much been up until, like, I guess the 90s, they've pretty much been under somebody's thumb since then, because they got conquered by Russia, and then they had independence again, I think World War I, and then they get conquered. There's the, what is it, the Ribbentrop-Volotov Treaty or whatever, where the Soviets...
Molotov-Ribbentrop. Yeah,
that's
Molotov-Ribbentrop
it. Molotov-Ribbentrop. It was also a good drink. And
the Russians, you know, Putin and the Russians would love you to forget that the, you know, the Soviets, you know, worked with the Nazis before they didn't.
Right, they were actually quite happy to split the nation in half, and then they were part of the Warsaw Pact for a while, and then they flipped and joined NATO.
And 20 years ago, actually, this March.
Yeah. So thank you, Poland, for doing that. So they're now our buddies, which is why some of the stuff that's happening over there is disconcerting. I am not as up on Polish developments in politics as you are. The things that I am peripherally aware of are that there has been an upswing in right-wing populism in Poland, and that tends to lend itself to nationalism and ethno-nationalism, both of which I think are disconcerting. And then the other thing is that being populists, they don't particularly like constitutional restraints or parliamentary norms, and so they've set out trying to castrate the courts. That way they can't stop the parliament from doing whatever it wants. And that's the main stuff that I'm aware of. Are there other disconcerting developments over there?
That's the stuff that's made the news is when the Law and Justice Party got into power in 2015, they very quickly moved to change what you'd call their Supreme Court, which is the Constitutional Tribunal, mm-hmm. as well as their major courts, and really try to, you know, pack those courts with people loyal to law and justice.
Yeah, didn't they like they put in, there was some sort of constitutional provision that the government can't remove judges, so they just put in a rule that all judges have to retire after X amount of years, and they flushed out like 40% of them overnight.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, they had a law that reduced it from, I think, 70-year-old mandatory retirement to 65, which immediately would have flushed out a huge chunk of the judges and then allowed them to put in their own judges.
Right.
And that, you know, that is, that is what the stuff that's made the Western press. And then there are other things that are just, you know, general annoyances where they basically mandated that any store over a certain, like 4,000 square feet has to close on Sundays.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So I notice when I'm there, like, how come the store's closed? It's like, oh, because it's Sunday now, and everybody, you know, rolls their eyes and says, we have to close the stores.
Great. Blue, what do you call it? They're like blue laws or something? I can't remember what those are called.
The blue laws. Like I grew up with in Massachusetts,
yeah.
You know, where you couldn't buy liquor on a weekend.
Yeah.
They've gone, you know, between, you know, that, and then, you know, I don't know if you've heard in the news lately, you know, they made it illegal to suggest that Poland had any kind of complicity in the Holocaust, which has, you know, stirred up a huge hornet's nest of, you know, all sorts of nasty things.
Which can we unpack that real quick? Because I did some research on that, and I'll say that they have a good historical point that they're making, because the Polish government did not collaborate with the Nazis. I assume that there were probably both, you know, guerrilla freedom fighters that were Polish. There probably were some collaborators as well, like in any war situation like that. But they make a decent point in that there wasn't like a Polish regime that was doing this on behalf of the Nazis. But at the same time, though, I think they've removed some of the they've knocked it down to a fine. But for a while, you would go to prison for 3 years if you used the phrase Polish death camp, or you implied that Poland was responsible in some way for the Holocaust.
Right. And they're very, you know, like they're very careful about stuff like that. For example, like, you know, Auschwitz, the name of, you know, the town where Auschwitz is actually Oświęcim, but, you know, it's in Poland. But they make sure you call it Auschwitz. You know, don't you dare call it Oświęcim.
So yeah, they want to have that stark division. Okay. Yeah, and I got to say that
a German word.
That freedom of speech is also very disconcerting to me, that you can or cannot say certain things like that. And also kind of weird in that I don't think I'd heard the phrase Polish death camp until I researched this. Like, I knew what a concentration camp was. I didn't even know what the phrase Polish death camp was. And because of this law, I am now weirdly aware of the thing that they don't want people to be aware of or think ever existed.
Right, it's like the Streisand effect.
Yeah.
There are several death camps that are in Poland that were, you know, Nazi-run death camps, and a lot of people forget that, you know, Poles suffered tremendously during the war, not just by having their, you know, country overrun by Germans and then Russians, but, you know, they lost a great deal of their intelligentsia. They were executed by the Russians.
Yeah.
They had their own people thrown into camps. You know, actually Auschwitz was, you know, started at a Polish military camp. It used to be it was a Polish camp, a barracks. And then they created Auschwitz II, which is Birkenau, the death camp.
Mm-hmm.
And then Auschwitz III, which is the Monowitz, which was the work labor camp, all in this complex of camps.
And they killed a fair amount of Polish people as well. A huge amount of the, I think 90% of the Polish Jewry died over the course of World War II. I assume that the bulk of that is through the Holocaust. But then on top of that, you've got, I think when there was a Warsaw Uprising, and the Germans did not allow that to go very far, and about 150,000 people died just in Warsaw, which and like burned 90% of the city down.
Yeah, well, that was the Powstanie Czterdziestych, I think they go. Warsaw, the 44th Uprising. So what the Russians did, this is what I learned just by virtue of having a Polish wife and spending a lot of time in Poland. You know, the Russians were so evil. What they did to the Polish resistance is they said, okay, you know, start fighting the Germans, and then we're going to come in and help you.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, okay. And they got all the Polish resistance to go, start fighting the Germans. And then the Russians just kind of sat there on the other side of the river and waited.
And then following it, I prosecuted quite a few of them, because when they came in, they went, no, this wasn't authorized communist activity. And wound up throwing him in jail and all that kind of stuff. So they had a bad run. That said, though, I am very disconcerted by any type of I'm disconcerted by any shrinking of freedom of speech or attempting to stifle freedom of speech. But in particular, when it is the government doing it for the very specific aim of perpetuating a given narrative, even if the narrative is accurate or primarily accurate, I don't want to have that external restraint threatening to throw me in jail for thinking or saying something that is heterodox.
Yeah, and it's very scary. Like, you know, the PIS has gone into, you know, they have a state channel called Telewizja Polska, and, you know, they've gone into that and really kind of taken it over, and it's really nothing more than a propaganda arm for the, you know, the incumbent party, and really demonizes the other parties, Platforma, which is the second most popular party in the country. Which would be like a center-right kind of party.
Mm-hmm.
They demonized them. And I don't know if you heard about this murder of the mayor of Gdansk.
No.
This year. So every Christmas, there is around every Christmas time, they have this thing that's the National Orchestra. What is it called? The National Orchestra, National Christmas Orchestra of Health, I think is how it translates. And it's a civilian-run thing. It's run by this old rock star, and they raise millions of dollars for children's hospitals.
Nice.
Except the Law and Justice Party has a problem with them, because the leader of this charity is outspoken and he's left-wing, and they don't like him. So they've really demonized this charity to their constituents. And what happened was, the mayor of Gdansk was a very liked mayor. What was his name? Pavel Adamovich was out there raising money for this charity and was stabbed to death by a convicted felon. It was a bank robber who had basically been, you know, fallen for the Law and Justice Party line and saw this guy Adamovich as kind of he's an enemy. He's working for this charity, and stabbed the guy to death. And the resulting outcry actually brought in so much money for children's hospitals, running like $26 million, which is almost $9 million more than last year.
Wow.
Which was phenomenal. And that was a way, you know, people were basically voting, you know, with their dollars to say this is unacceptable. And, you know, but this guy's dead largely as a result of being demonized, as, you know, this charity being demonized by this, you know, the incumbent party.
Which
a lot of stuff.
Which is also, I think, one of the very troubling developments that tends to accompany populism. If you voted for Trump or Bernie Sanders, I'm not saying that you want to go stab a mayor, but populism does tend to have a demagogue effect where it centers around, you know, a strong guy ruler. And it also tends to be predicated less on an ideological structure and more on a temperamental worldview, which is there are the people who are, you know, sort of inherently good salt of the earth folks, and they're getting screwed over by some group. And the group is terrible, and it's usually like a traitorous element within our own society that needs to be, you know, run out of town. Populism doesn't tend to come with a live and let live attitude. It tends to come in a very othering capacity that wants to demonize something, and that is a disturbing thing to see rise in Poland.
Yeah, I mean, these guys, you know, and they've really done it. You know, they've taken the immigrant issue. And really stoked the fires there,
yeah,
because they saw what happened in Germany right next door to them, and they really preyed on the fears of people, you know, that there was going to be this flood of immigrants from Syria and other Muslim nations, and they've really played that to their population or to their constituency.
Which is an interesting thing too, because they are an EU member state, and the EU is not, its laws are not voluntary. It's not like a trade pact where you just kind of go in and you do what you feel like doing, you know, in a buffet style. It has laws, and they've threatened to like basically remove Poland's voting rights from the EU a couple of times. I don't know if they're going to wind up doing it or not, but they were worried enough about the court system, which would kind of, I think, yeah, it would sort of be like if Montana just went, you know what, we're getting rid of courts, the governor's going to handle it. Like, we would all go, what now?
Yeah, the EU is basically, I think Article 7 is what they call it. They basically threatened to remove their voting rights, which caused them, Law and Justice Party, to kind of back down on some of these reforms. But they're, you know, there's still the intent there. They're just trying to figure out ways they can get away with it. And they've taken a largely Eurosceptic attitude, mm-hmm, towards the EU, which is funny because, you know, Donald Tusk, who was the former president of the opposition party, the Platforma, which is, mm-hmm, Civic Platform, PO.
Yeah.
You know, he is now an EU minister.
Yeah, I think he's like the head of the Council he's the president of there's like eight different,
yeah,
there's
he's
like the Council of Europe and the European Council. They need to get better names, right, in my opinion. And he's,
right,
the head of one of those two things.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's odd too that I feel like Poland had they kind of came in the late 90s or I guess the early 2000s with this sort of EU promise, which was, you've thrown off communism, and if you want to ally with our bloc, we're going, right, to integrate you and move you into this. So it's interesting that they're having this kind of nationalist reflexive kickback where they're not wanting to do it.
It's a weird thing. And it's also weird because it's not like they're kicking back and turning towards Russia, because, you know, Kaczynski, Jarosław Kaczynski, who's kind of the head of the Law and Justice Party, you know, hates Putin, hates Russia.
Okay.
You know, they want to dredge up old communists from Poland and put them on trial. I mean, so it's kind of weird. They're kind of alienating themselves from the EU, but also alienating themselves from Russia. But they are kissing up to the U.S.
To who?
To the U.S.
Okay. Well, that kind of makes sense, because it's we've got a right wing populist in the White House who is a, you know, purported nationalist and a anti-immigrant. And Hungary, I think, is doing something very similar. And so, like, and for whatever reason, yeah, even though that kind of right wing populism tends to have xenophobia built into it, they get along with other populist right wing nationalist states, because they're all kind of purporting this, you know, hyper sovereignty nationalism thing. You know, the our group for our group kind of thinking.
Yeah, Andrzej Duda, who is their current president, proposed to opening a Fort Trump in Poland. What he's trying to do, and it's actually worked, is to bring more military presence into Poland. And in fact, we just announced that recently, like today, and I just saw a news article on that they did go ahead and they're going to move an armor base near east of Poznan, which is in the northwest of Poland.
That's
which used to be. Huh?
I was going to say, that's brilliant, and I'm surprised no one's thought about that yet. That if a European country is like, you know what, we could use a military base in this little town. Like, we don't remember the mill's kind of shut down. We could use some tanks and, you know, have some commerce. We'll just rename it like it was, you know, Bratislava Nova, and we'll rename it Trumpburg. And then, like, yeah, I think you could probably appeal to the ego and largesse of the president pretty easily.
And I guess it worked, but it's not going to be called Fort Trump, but it is. We are going to have, I think, 15,000 troops there in an armor contingency, I guess, in case the Russians attack the Baltics or something.
What can you kind of outline what the politics look like in Poland in general? There's the Law and Justice Party. That's the in-power, ascendant, right-wing populist wing. What kind of stuff are they running on, and what are the opposition parties look like?
There are basically three main parties right now. So you've got the Law and Justice Party, which is PIS, and then Civic Platform, PO, coming in second. And then third is a newly announced party called Spring.
Okay. It sounds fun.
Old nurse. It's something, and you know they've got a hard task ahead of them because the head of Spring is a gay atheist. That's winning the identity Olympics. Like he's really giving it a shot.
But he's also doing it in Poland, which is kind of lurching more towards the sort of white Christian Europe model, at least with the right wing, right? Like it strikes me as less more homogenous than we are, and so perhaps less inclined towards identity politics. I don't know. We're inclined towards Polish identity politics.
Well, he's popular in basically cities like urban, Warsaw, Krakow, Gdansk. You know, he's popular there. He's popular with the young kids because they're not as influenced by the Catholic Church. The major law and justice voting bloc is really in rural areas, and then they skew older, and the derogatory terms for some would be like the Mohorova, which is the old ladies who wear the mohair berets. And they're kind of the old Catholic grandmother, and they're short and they have thick glasses, wool braids. They're called Mohorova, and those are law and justice voting bloc.
Okay.
And there's a lot of them. And and one of the reasons this party got a majority in 2015 is because a lot of the younger kids didn't vote.
Mm.
A lot of them were actually just abroad working in Europe. I mean, my brother-in-law himself was over in England working. And so they just didn't get around to voting. And the only people who were enthusiastic voters were really the older folks who were kind of worried about their country changing.
Yeah.
And then the party has gone out and, done things to promote childbirth in the country. They've started paying people $150 a month for every child they have after the first.
Yeah, I thought was also fascinating because they've got this kind of – They're right-wing populists. They've got the nationalist thing going, but they're also doing the kind of government handouts that we associate with, like, Nordic countries, where I think they're actually paying parents more than the Norwegians give their parents at this point, which...
Yeah, it's clearly kind of buying votes. I mean, they're throwing money at pensioners. They're doing tax cuts for young kids. I mean, not young, for everybody, but they really help the young. And it's costing them a fortune. Like, I know there's like $10 billion to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to change, I think, right before the elections, want even the first child to get to be worth $150 a month. So they're really incentivizing, people to have kids.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I said go ahead.
I was going to say, it's interesting watching this because I feel like it's a kind of a nexus point to see of what's happening globally a lot of the places, some of the conversations we're having here in the United States and happening throughout Europe, where you've got the sort of old liberal order, and I'm saying this in a European sense. So when I say liberal, I mean like classical liberal, the idea of parliamentary restraints, robust civil society as opposed to state, that liberal, that's kind of... That's been overtaken by the right-wing populists, and the liberals are having to figure out, do they want to double down on the old school liberal of, big society, lack of state, that kind of thing, or do they want to try and go socialist? And I wonder how that'll play out in Poland, whether they'll view, kind of liberalism and capitalism as part of the problem, or whether they'll want to do that but accompany it with, liberal democracy, or how they're apt to respond to politically counter the populists.
I think socialism is a much, much harder sell in Poland.
Okay.
because
they actually experienced it. To tell people about how wonderful socialism is when they've actually been to a breadline before.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, my wife would tell you firsthand, like, oh, have you ever had vanilla ice cream that had no vanilla in it? No, that's socialist, you know. And you know, there's nobody there who I know that thinks that would be a good idea.
Yeah, that makes total sense to me. Socialism makes sense in Vermont, where you haven't, you know.
It makes sense to people who are very distant from it, who don't have relatives who grew up in it.
Yeah.
You know, my wife's family, they were the rebels in the village because they had a greenhouse, and they were using the greenhouse to grow vegetables to make extra money. Mm-hmm. And they were looked down upon by other people in the village for their capitalistic instinct.
Ah, they sound horrible.
growing
turnips over there. Are you and your wife, are you worried about Poland in general? Is this just, do you see this as kind of an irritating blip? Do you see it as foreboding? What's the emotional state with her and her family regarding the homeland?
Yeah, you know, none of her family is happy with the current government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's an election coming up in October, a parliamentary election, you know, where there's a chance they might, they could lose the majority. The Law and Justice Party could lose the majority, but there's also a chance they won't. I mean, it's not a given. People aren't, you know, the number two party, Platforma, you know, is a center right party. And a lot of the younger folks, I think, still, you know, have issues with them because they're not pro gay marriage. They're anti-abortion. Yeah. They're not, I mean, they're not like, the Democrats or something. They are just less right wing than.
So they've got like the Republican Party and the red hat Trump Republican Party.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
And then you have this new party Spring, which is, you know, building momentum. And I think it's polling at like 14% or something, but you know, I think, you know, getting the older folks to vote for a gay atheist is a tough sell.
I'll say gay atheist governor of Oklahoma would be a tough coup to pull off. Perhaps, yeah. I think we had a blind atheist senator at one point, but it was really early in statehood. And
I can't believe because I can't see him.
That's how that works. Yeah, exactly. And people are like, you know what? The logic is resolute. So we have a problem. There's no problem with that guy. We'll send him to Washington. I'm curious to see how that plays out. I think, given the history with fascism and everything else in that part of Europe, it's always, I kind of go, when I see the word nationalism popping up in news reports, that always kind of worries me and burns me. Do you think it's likely to balance out again, or do you think that they will like have their own Brexit and form a, you know, ethno-nationalist Polish country that is independent, or how do you see it playing out?
I mean, you know, there has been mumbling. You've had some of these, you know, Polish government officials mumbling about the EU and getting out of the EU, and that would be the stupidest possible thing for them to do, because I've witnessed personally how much they've benefited by their EU membership since I started going there in 2000.
Yeah.
And to see the buildings go from concrete, you know, to gray, to actually having paint on them, to see highways go from, you know, apple cart tracks to actual highways. I mean, they've benefited tremendously, and everybody there who I know knows that.
Because they're part of a giant trade bloc, and they've got that going for them. So, like, you can, like, the EU, you could argue the EU is protectionist. It's not protectionist within member states. So Poland's open to that. The labor market's there, and I think with Polish people, I gathered that they do what a lot of people do, is they'll go work in another country for 3 or 4 years, but then they'll come back because they don't necessarily want to settle there. And then on top of that, the EU has given them billions of dollars. Like, it's giving tremendous amounts of infrastructure investment and all that kind of stuff. So they've financially benefited from it quite a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I've witnessed the road from my wife's village to the town of Poznan used to take us about 3 hours, and now they put highways in it, and it takes us an hour and a half.
Great.
You know, because it used to be like single lane highways and constantly passing people and, you know, risking death every time you tried to overtake a vehicle. And, you know, they have benefited tremendously.
A couple of questions as we approach the end. We talked about the law prohibiting discussion of Polish death camps and implying that Poland was responsible. One of the things that I think is really disturbing right now in the United States is that anti-Semitism either seems to be on the rise, or alternately, that anti-Semites that were being quiet have decided they're going to come out in the open. I had kind of thought that America had not really had that, or had you know, around World War II gone, oh, we should drop this or something like that. And it seems to be percolating and it's disturbing. And I think it would be far more disturbing if I were Jewish. I have no idea what it's like in Poland, whether they are whether Jewish people are seen as in a very sympathetic light given the Holocaust, or whether they're also giving into that really old European anti-Semitism. Like, what is your read on that?
They're viewed with a mix of, you know, curiosity, and I think the older folks, you know, there's a resentment. But yeah, I remember when I was there in Krakow after my wedding, and my wife and I had a bunch of friends who were with me in Krakow, and we were taking a little tour, and this girl was driving a golf cart around and showing us things, and she points to the synagogue, and she goes, "And this is the Jewish church, and for some reason they're open on Saturdays." Weird.
Yeah, what a funky denomination.
How weird is that? You know, I have seen it percolating. I mean, there's definitely, they've kind of made it easier for these people to kind of come out of the woodwork and say things. And I noticed it myself when I was there over Christmas. And in the markets, they have these things. They're called Lucky Jews.
Uh-huh. Go on.
And they are pictures. I'll send you a picture of the Lucky Jew afterwards. So there are these little dolls that it's a Jewish figure with like a, you know, the yarmulke, and he's wearing a prayer shawl, uh-huh, and usually holding a bag of money or a coin.
Uh-huh.
And for good luck.
Okay.
And I see them in gift shops. I just see them in gift shops all the time. You know, and I asked my wife about it one time. She's like, "Yeah, it's just some stupid, you know, traditional thing we have." And I took a picture of it and I put it on Twitter joking about, you know, this still exists, like this is kind of weird. And, you know, I got a lot of anti-Semitic hate from people, some of whom accused me of, you know, lying and fabricating that they exist.
That, I got to say, that's a very odd response. If you're like, "Hey, like, because I'm what you're describing to me either sounds like on the most benign level, it sounds like kind of the fat Buddha that you sometimes see in Chinese restaurants. And it's like that's associated with luck and money, except that for whatever reason, they've picked the Jews who like money, apparently. And I'm like, that's getting into some anti-Semitic tropes here pretty quick. And so when you put that online, people that you weren't even addressing, like, stepped up to be like, "How dare you? We just happen to really enjoy Jewish figurines clutching gold." And
this is a Jewish plot. You know, this is why do the Jews perpetrate this? It's like, wait a second. It was in a gift shop in Warsaw.
Yeah. I'm on Team Brian on that one. That sounds like weird protesters there. And then how about are they going through culture wars? Is that something that's happening in Poland? I mean, we're enjoying this delightful protracted struggle here in the United States. Do they have some parallel?
No. And I love it.
Wow. Okay.
No, my wife just rolls her eyes at 90% of the news she sees in the States. She's like, mm-hmm. There'll be this new, the gender unicorn poster. It's like, what? And she just looks at the stuff like, what's wrong with you people? And, you know, what she tells us time and again is that we haven't had enough hardship. That, as Americans, we've grown up spoiled, and so we're just looking for things to be upset about.
There might be something to that.
I think there's something there because, you know, she grew up under socialism and communism, and she's no fan and she doesn't tolerate BS. And, she sees us kind of being ridiculous and wonders what the hell we're thinking when we have it so good.
Wonderful. Well, hey, Brian, I appreciate you coming on. It was fun to talk to you. And I feel like as a result of this, people listening, at some point during the year, you're going to be getting ice cream or you're going to be, you know, on the carousel. I don't know. I assume all of my listeners are constantly at carnivals. And you're going to meet someone visiting from Krakow, and you're going to remember this episode, and you're going to sound so smart by virtue of being like, "Hey, what do you think about the justice and law party? Excuse me, law and justice party?" And then they're going to hoist you onto their shoulders and make you an honorary Pole and give you the keys to the city. It's going to be great.
And you can give them ice cream that has vanilla in it.
Yes, because we have a free market. Brian, thank you so much. It was fun to have you. Please come back on again.
Sure.
Little bit of listener feedback before we wrap up. Titanic to the Electric Bogaloo says on iTunes, "What can be said about this podcast that hasn't been said about The Wheel, iPhone, polio vaccine, and Dance Dance Revolution? I'm not saying this podcast will bring back your loved ones, but I'm not saying it won't. Funny and entertaining. Thumbs up." Hey, thank you very much. And I appreciate that. Did you know, listeners, that every time you subscribe to my podcast, an angel gets a scholarship. We've put over 10,000 angels through community college, 4,000 through the University of Phoenix, and 8 got into Columbia until it turns out that their moms were bribing the university. But if you subscribe to my podcast, you are literally making the world a better place. And if you subscribe today, I'm officially giving you the day off. Just saunter right into your boss's office and say, Heaton told me I can take the day off. Peace. And walk out. Remember, you can always tweet me at Mighty Heaton or Facebook me at facebook.com/Mighty Heaton, or even email me by subscribing to my newsletter at MightyHeaton.com and just replying when I send it out on Fridays. I'd also like to encourage you to subscribe to Blaze TV and download the Blaze TV app. If you do, you can watch me instead of just listening to me. Use the promo code Heaton to get $10 off your annual Blaze TV subscription. I look like Bob Newhart's coat rack, but with twice the personality. Thank you, Jennings. And he wrote that. And for those at home, you watching know that I was brandishing a weapon earlier. On the podcast side, you just have to take it on faith. So download the Blaze TV app on iTunes or Google Play, get subscribed to the Blaze, and then fall in love with me more than you already are. You can also watch portions of the show on Facebook Watch by going to facebook.com/HeatonTV. Finally, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. That helps other people discover this here political orphanage. Thank you, and good day.